Good morning, it's 9:30, the reading of the Green Valley News for Monday, July 27th, Mark DeGroft with you. On March 25th of 2020, our first article titled Exploring Arizona appeared in the Green Valley News. For 5 years, the focus of our articles was about the exploration of our adopted state of Arizona. Due to popular demand, however, in May of 2025, we started introducing articles about our journey across the lower 48 states. Since that time, we've had positive feedback and additional questions about what did you see in my state. Thank you for your questions and your feedback. We will continue to include our cross-country journey articles in between our Arizona articles, and we thank you for the opportunity to relive our adventures in your state as we view hundreds of our photos. Meandering the Mesquite. During our 21-month cross-country journey, we crossed the state line into Wisconsin on October 10th of 2008. We were excited and eager to explore the state known as America's Dairyland due to its dairy products and the state with two coastlines along the Great Lakes, the one along Lake Michigan and one along Lake Superior. With the state map and our list of things to see, we set off to explore our new territory. In this state, we chose to explore two scenic drives and one scenic trail. On the Great River Road Scenic Drive, we took photos of the Mississippi River barges, stopped to explore Lake Pepin in Stockholm, took photos of Maiden Rock, spent time at the Great River Road Visitor and Learning Center in Prescott, stopped in DeSoto to read historical markers, stopped at Laura Ingalls Wilder Birthplace in Stockholm, took photos of Lock and Dam No. 4 in Alma, stopped to admire the unique Bow and Arrow Rock Formation, explored the site of Redbird's Village near present-day DeSoto, took photos of Mercord Mill Park in Prescott, and took a photo of the unique village directory in Pepin. At the St. Croix Ice Age National Scenic Trail, We spent time exploring the areas set aside to protect potholes and other geologic features formed by melting glaciers about 10,000 years ago. We sat by the rock formations near the gorge, took a photo of the Old Man of the Dales, and took photos of unique rock formations and the fascinating potholes. On the 66-mile Door County Coastal Byway, we sat on impressive rock formations, and we admired the coastline at Cave County Pawnee Park in Sturgeon Bay. We took photos of the Canna Island Lighthouse, admired the boats in Sister Bay, stopped to explore the Lethem and Smith Quarry, strolled along the seashore at Whitefish Dune State Park, walked through George K. Piney County Park, formerly the Old Stone Quarry Park, took photos at Death's Door and ate lunch in Sister Bay at the famous Al Johnson Swedish restaurant in Butik, where goats roamed the grass-covered roof while we enjoyed our meal. We did enjoy our meal and got excellent photos of the goats. Whenever we plan a trip, our inner child also insists that we include some sights that will excite them. In Wisconsin, we found 4 sights that met the criteria. In Beloit, we spent an afternoon at the Angel Museum viewing all sizes, colors, and styles of hundreds of fascinating and beautiful angels. We also strolled around the grounds to take photos of the larger angel sculptures. In Baraboo, we spent hours in the Circus World Museum taking photos of Cinderella's carriage, clown mask, dozens of circus posters, and impressive circus wagons. We also had the opportunity to spend some time wandering around the Ringling Brothers Circus Winter Quarters, listed as a National Historic Landmark. In Waupun, we wandered through the small community, locating and taking photos of impressive sculptures, including at the end of the trail, listed on the National Register of Historic Places, the Joy of Music, the Recording Angel, and several others. At Wisconsin River Dells, we took photos in the amusement area and enjoyed a relaxing boat tour through the Dells, where we also took photos of stunning and interesting rock formations and chatted with travelers from other states and countries. During the prep for our cross-country journey, we made ourselves a promise that we would explore all and photograph all 48 state capitals. Arriving in Madison, we headed to the State Capitol building and then spent the morning exploring the site. We wandered the grounds, took photos of the Capitol building and the impressive sculptures on the structure, wandered inside to explore the East Gallery, took photos of the ceiling in the governor's conference room, viewed the interior of the Supreme Court, took photos of the stained glass windows in the North Hearing Room, entered the Senate chambers, took photos of the impressive rotunda, and made sure to take a photo of the Badger sculpture. This Capitol building was truly impressive. Whenever we entered a new state, we always took advantage of exploring some national and state parks that have been set aside for our enjoyment. And our list of places to see in the state of Wisconsin, we included three national and state parks. We explored the Kettle Moraine State Forest in Campbellsport, where we took photos of Dundee Mountain, stopped to explore Greenbush Kettle, ventured to Kettle Lake, and spent time at the Harry S. Roos Ice Age Visitor Center, where we viewed the exhibits. At Patterson State Park in Superior, we explored another area of the state that contains the remnants of the Ice Age, sat and listened to the roar of the Big Manitou Falls, and ventured to the top of the hills. At Apostle Islands National Lakeshore in Bayfield, we spent time at the Visitor Center, gathered information on the area, and took photos of the lake. On that day, however, we were unable to access a tour boat to the islands, a beautiful place to enjoy the magnificence of Mother Nature. On all of our travel maps, we also highlighted some historic sites that we wanted to explore in each and every state. Five were highlighted in Wisconsin. Arriving at the Lac du Flambeau Indian Reservation, we headed to the George W. Brown Jr. Ojibwe Museum and Cultural Center, and then spent hours gathering historical information, enjoying interactive exhibits, having discussions with the docents, and taking photos of the historic pottery and the impressive sculptures. In Namur, an unincorporated community in Door County, we stopped to explore the largest Belgium settlement in the United States. On that day, we ventured through the town, stopped to take photos of Our Lady of the Snows Church, including the unique cemetery situated nearby, and we read the historical markers. Near Mineral Point, we stopped to explore the site of the former Fort Defiance. On that day, we read the information on the historical marker and took photos of that stone marker. In Sheboygan, we visited the Sheboygan Indian Mound Park that contains 18 rare Native American burial grounds. We wandered through the site, read the information signs, and took photos of the effigy mounds, a worthwhile stop with abundant information about effigy mounds and burial practices. In Spring Green, we headed to Taliesin, spent time at the Frank Lloyd Wright Visitor Center, took long-distance photos of the estate, toured the house, and enjoyed our time exploring the amazing and creative house which served as Frank Lloyd Wright's primary residence for many years. It was an honor to be able to explore a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Exploring cities was not our primary goal during our time in the Lower 48. On occasion, however, we did venture into some cities. We ventured into three cities in the state of Wisconsin. Along the Lake Superior coast, we stayed overnight in Ashland, where we spent our time walking on the boardwalk near Lake Superior, and then taking photos of impressive, large, and colorful murals. We found murals in McDonald's, on storefronts, on industrial buildings, in the lobby at the Best Western, and on store windows. What a delightful and cheerful place to spend a night. In Washburn, we also encountered some impressive murals on store fronts, church windows, and industrial buildings. And in Milwaukee, we spent time with a dear friend, explored the downtown area, took photos of the skyline, sat along the waterfront, took photos of the lighthouses, enjoyed walking along Lake Michigan, and decided to visit the largest art museums in the United States. During our trip visit to the museum, we took photos of the unique and interesting structure that was designed by internationally renowned Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava, and enjoyed hours of quiet time viewing hundreds of art pieces by Andy Warhol, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Picasso, Auguste Rodin, Giorgio O'Keeffe, Dale Chihuly, and many other well-known artists. We enjoyed exploring the state of Wisconsin and having shared some of our time with other explorers and adventurers. It is a state that at times reminded us of the New England states, and we fondly remember our venture. Even today, we remember some special moments, such as staying overnight in a small Amish motel in Pepin, where we met adventurers from Dodge City, Kansas, and we had the opportunity to wander to the edge of the Mississippi River to watch barges heading south. At this point, we're certain some of you are thinking we forgot to include one important site in the article. Truthfully, we did not venture to Bloomingdale to explore the Mall of America. Travels with Two Sisters. About 40 people attending a meeting on Wednesday at the Canoa Ranch Sewer Extension Project and underway at the I-19 West Frontage Road. The meeting was led by Guillermo Mimo Aguirre, Senior Project Manager for Hunter Contracting, which is constructing the line. Aguirre said they initially believed that since the project affects no businesses and had minimal impact on residents, that there was no need for a public meeting. But many of the many phone calls received an electronic message board went up, announcing the road closure changed his mind. Here's a rundown of what was covered. So what's being done? Phase one of the project is the installation of 7,100 feet of new sewer line from Canoa Road south of the roundabout to the Canoa Ranch rest area. The project will improve and expand wastewater infrastructure in the area for future development where sewer service is currently unavailable. Phase two of the project, still in the design phase, will continue south on the frontage road before it crosses under I-19 at Elephant Head Road to connect to a 12-inch county sewer system on the eastern side. The estimated cost of phase one is $11.6 million. So what are the restrictions? The west frontage road from the south of Canoa Ranch traffic circle to Elephant Head Road, which is about a mile north of Amato, closed on July 13th and will reopen on September 22nd of 2027, about 14 months. The roundabout is open except to head south on the frontage road. When does the sewer line actually go in? Work starts on August 4th and concludes on June 4th of 2027. Aguirre said they expect to install 70 to 100 feet of line every day. After that, the frontage road will be replaced and restriped because it likely will be damaged by big construction vehicles driving on it during the project. Why does the entire road have to be closed? Keeping it open was unsafe and would have extended the 14-month closure to at least 24 months. Trenches in some spots will go 20 feet deep, and with dirt embankments, berms, and other restrictions, it's a tight fit, particularly with big construction equipment moving up and down the road. Can't they work at night and keep the road open during the day? This too would extend the project to 24 months or beyond. It would take 2 to 4 hours each day to open and close the road. Are there any other issues? Not that they can see, according to Aguirre. Very few people would be affected by the noise, and there is no existing infrastructure, that being utilities, sewer lines, etc., affected. A water truck will keep the dust down. We also feel dust is a hazard for any guys working on the site, so we work to minimize that, Aguirre said. So who do I call if I have questions, complaints, or comments? You can call Aguirre at 520-268-7604, 520-268-7604. Aravaca residents have taken the reins of a 5-acre agricultural property in hopes of turning it around while growing self-sustaining crops and a stronger sense of community. The former Aravaca Community Garden, under the management of Tucson-based nonprofit Portable Practical Education Preparation, has shifted to an 8-member board of residents, and they established a new nonprofit under the name of Aravaca Co-op. The board is also gathering as much volunteer support from the community as it can, and have logged nearly 600 hours since March with 20 to 30 people. Board member Glo Williams said that the transition process went into full swing in February when PPEP relinquished control. The property remains a part of the Arnold Family Trust, which includes PPEP founder John Arnold. Board member Lucas Miller said that Arnold and the trust have provided Aravaca Co-op a beneficial lease to hit the ground running. But Miller said operations under previous management lacked community volunteers, underutilized the property's 5 acres, and left the soil in need of rehabilitation. The property has crops growing on about 2 of the 5 acres that includes 3 large greenhouses, fields, and several small structures, such as a bunkhouse, seating greenhouse, processing tables, and storage areas. We're getting some vegetables, but the soil wasn't a priority, so we started seeing issues, Williams said. We just kind of switched around the priorities to improve the soil and to make it nice and healthy and introduce a regenerative method. The garden under PPEP reported it had produced up to 16,000 pounds of produce annually. Miller said Arivaca Co-op's goal is to eventually meet and exceed that amount. The board introduced goats and chickens to the property as part of a closed-loop regenerative process that will rebuild the soil's health one section at a time. The process will eventually be an ongoing effort that will maintain a paddock's health after investing in harvesting a crop. A paddock is a small sectioned-off part of a pasture that is used for grazing or livestock. Miller said the goats start the process by eating leftover vegetation and weeds, clearing the land, and then leaving droppings in their wake. He said their hooves stamp it into the ground while they meander. The process follows with a flock of chickens in the existing paddock while the goats move on to a new one using mobile fences. They eat the bugs that are eating the manure. They're also then pooping and doing their work too, Miller said of the chickens. So we don't plant while that manure is being composted into the earth. It's just a rest and repair state. Miller said it could be a slow process to rebuild the soil's health, and it depends on how many goats and chickens are available. The co-op has a small flock of chickens and 3 goats, but Miller said they expect to double the goats soon, and some residents have donated chickens that they've hatched. Miller said soil wakes up during the monsoon and needs the water to help break down the materials, which he said doesn't happen when it's in a dry state. He said using goats and chickens is a great way to replenish the soil, adding that growing crops takes its toll on the soil, especially here in the desert. The co-op plans to rotate the fields, growing on replenished paddocks while rehabilitating harvested areas, and so on. Miller said the process also cuts down on feed and fertilizer costs, as the goats and chickens eat a lot of amaranth on the property. Then the whole idea with the goat thing is once we've harvested these plants, we don't need to pull them, Miller said. We just move the fences again, set the paddock right over it, and let the goats do their thing. They're going to mow this to the ground, and nothing is wasted. Williams said the group was skeptical about how many weeds the 3 goats would be able to clear on the property that needed some renewed attention. I mean, we had weeds that are taller than us and the goats. You were just like, there's no way. It's going to take them a year to eat all that, Williams said. And they pretty much got it all down to the stem. We didn't do that. They did it. The co-op is on the hunt for wood chips and compost to help build up the organic matter in the soil. Miller said the ground is clay-rich, but lacks organic matter such as grass and bark and wood. It's got a good base, but we need to continue to feed it if it's going to feed us, Miller said. Miller has spent 20 years in agriculture, with community-supported agriculture programs in Iowa, and working on the nonprofit Seed Savers Exchange. He said nutrition has dropped in food due to overtaxed and underperforming soil. What a tomato had in its mineral and vitamin content in the 50s is very different than now, he said, because people continue to grow the same things over and over, and they say, well, there's a tomato on the vine. That must mean it's good. The gardens have been using several small plots for row crops, with much of the rest remaining open space or is being used for compost piles. The property has also 3 large greenhouses for other crops, and they house large evaporative cooling systems that keep the temperature mild even during southern Arizona's scorching summers. Miller said the temperature in the greenhouse would be around 120 to 130 degrees this time of year without the coolers. We've just gotten so many resources with them turning this farm over to us that we just want to make the best of it, optimize what we can do here, Williams said. The co-op said that in the greenhouse growing tomatoes now, while the other 2 remain dormant. The co-op is also rehabilitating new sections of land, and that will open up more area for row crops. Williams said it could effectively double the effective growing space. He expects it'll take about 4 years to get the fields up to snuff and have the co-op moving at full speed. We just applied for a grant that's considerable when we be able to hire a full-time garden manager and a support person. That's going to be guided by the board. Then we'd be able to have full control of what these folks are doing, and soil regeneration is a big part of what they're prioritizing. The co-op also plans to sell food box subscriptions in the future, and that will help keep it a self-sustaining operation. Miller said it's too early for details on them, but they plan to use and build those annually to fund the co-op's needs. He said it would be a mixed bag of getting food to people who need it and those who want it. The co-op plans to sell subscriptions to the Arivaca Human Resource, an area nonprofit that helps with resources and other assistance, including food. Miller said going through Arivaca HR would help keep community-grown food available for people who can't afford that subscription. The co-op also hopes to grow subscription sales to other community members who can cover the cost. Ultimately, Miller said the idea is to have the locally grown food available community-wide in Arivaca. And that's the reason why we started the advisory board in the first place, because all of the food was going to Tucson, he said. It was like, hey, what about us, you know? We should keep some of that food here. She said the co-op is still working on identifying their identity at the end of the day. Williams said the co-op wants to explore added value options like goat cheese, pickles, and other jars of stuff. The co-op is looking at other ways to keep costs down as well. Miller and Williams broke down corn on Wednesday that was harvested just a couple of days earlier. Miller said that the corn, a native variety that grows in 60 to 80 day cycles, would be dried and used as seed for future crops. Miller said 1 year could produce $20 worth of seeds. He said that would be a big savings for the co-op, and it would also promote their self-sustaining operation. The co-op recently harvested onions and garlic, the lone remnant crop handed over from previous management. But the new board and its volunteers have already more corn to harvest, as well as purple variety growing. The fields also have squash, watermelons, and other produce that is sprouting up. The board has no shortage of work getting the operation to where they want it to be in the next 4 years. They pursue their nonprofit status, attain their certified organic status, and keep rehabilitating the soil. They keep working on seeing how field operations will work. The board also said that its work is cut out for them in deciding what will offer to the public and the community going forward, both in products and in involvement. But this year, we're just happy to get things in the ground, Miller said. Justice of the Peace Ray Carroll retained his seat on Tuesday against fellow Republican challenger Kara Egbert. With most of the ballots counted, Carroll led with 7,035 votes, or 59.5%. Egbert, the current Suarita vice mayor, at 4,753, or 40.2%. There's no Democrat in the primary, and this opens the door to Carroll in the November election. Pima County has about 400 more votes to count on Friday and a very small number of provisional ballots. Carroll was appointed to the JP position in 2017 after spending 19 years on the Pima County Board of Supervisors. He won the seat in 2018 and 2022. Egbert is finishing a term on the Sorita Town Council, where she is vice mayor. Incumbent Democrat State Representative Consuelo Hernandez retains her House seat in LD21, but the race is close for the second seat. On Thursday evening, Hernandez had 10,159 votes in the district, and that included part of Suarita and Green Valley. Incumbent Stephanie Stahl Hamilton trailed the challenger Miranda Lopez by 276 votes, 8,637 to 8,361. Maritza Higuera was fourth with 6,936. Republican Esteban Flores ran unopposed in the GOP primary for Senate in the heavily Democratic district. State Senator Rosanna Gabaldon, a Democrat, ran also opposed. In the GOP primary for House and Legislative District 19, Republican incumbents David Gowan and Lupe Diaz headed off challenger Cheryl Caswell. There are two Democratic challengers in heavily Republican LD19 for the House, Jackie O'Donnell Anderson and Aiden Nicolette Swallow, who both advanced to the November general election. Republican Senator State Senator Gail Griffin ran unopposed in the primary. There was no Democratic candidate in the Senate primary, meaning that Griffin will go out and challenge in November. LD19 includes most of Green Valley and reaches over to Cochise County. Pima County had about 400 votes left to count on Friday, while Santa Cruz County had about 285 outstanding votes. And this day in history, July 27th, in 1540, Thomas Cromwell was executed. He had been the chief advisor to King Henry VIII of England. He arranged a marriage between Henry and Anne of Cleves in order to secure an alliance with German nobles. But Henry found Anne unattractive, and the alliance fell apart. The king blamed Cromwell for both and had him executed for treason. In 1586, Sir Walter Raleigh brings tobacco to England. The explorer was represented and presented with tobacco by Native Americans in Virginia, and he brought it over to England, where it was widely popular. He was later granted a charter to establish tobacco plantations in the New World. In 1816, the deadliest cannon shot in history was fired. During the Battle of Negro Fort, fought between the escaped slaves and their Choctaw and Seminole allies against the United States Army, a U.S. gunboat fired a shell at the fort. It exploded in the fort's powder magazine, causing a massive explosion that killed more than 250 defenders and ended the battle. In 1866, the transatlantic cable was completed. The undersea cable was laid between Ireland and Newfoundland and reduced the time it took to get a message across the Atlantic from 10 days to just 17 hours. In 1974, the Russian ballet dancer Mikhail Baryshnikov, the ballet dancer, defected from the Soviet Union to Canada in June. In his debut, he danced with the American Ballet Theater in a production of Giselle in New York City. And in 1996, the Olympics were bombed. In Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta, a pipe bomb exploded in the public park during the Summer Olympics. The bombing was committed by the American Christian terrorist Eric Robert Rudolph to protest abortion. A security guard, Richard Jewell, discovered the bomb and cleared most of the crowd out of the park. Jewell was initially hailed as a hero, but later became a suspect himself. In 2006, he was publicly thanked by the governor of Georgia for his life-saving actions. The Green Valley News for Monday. Mark DeGroft with you. Thanks for joining me this morning. Stay tuned for more Sun Sounds programming back on Wednesday. Till then, stay cool and take care.